Science.
Questions.
Radio.
Welcome to Science Questions. I am Sherry Quinn.
And I am Susie Montgomery. Epigenetics is setting the stage for a major shift in biology, disease, and medicine.
Simply put, it is the study of heritable changes in gene activity that do not alter the genetic code. Epi means above. The epigenome essentially sits atop the genome and conducts our genes, telling them to switch on or off, to be quiet or loud. Every cell type in the body has its own epigenome, and that is what instructs them to become either a skin cell, a heart cell, or a brain cell, and so on. Humans have roughly 200 different cell types in the body. The part that has scientists young and old really excited is the surprising plasticity of the epigenome, meaning environmental factors such as diet, exercise, stress, social environment, pollutants, and nutrition can mark the epigenome, or alter it. And those marks or tags can be passed down to at least one generation. Scientists so far believe the early stages of development in the womb are the most vulnerable to epigenetic changes from environmental factors. And the details of this science get much more complex. But this is just a primer. The introduction started with Randy Jurdle last year, when I interviewed him at the University of Utah, where he was presenting a talk. Jurdle is the director of the Epigenetics and Imprinting Laboratory at Duke University in North Carolina, and a leading pioneer of the field.
Thanks to him, SQ Radio was invited to attend and cover the Keystone Symposia Environmental Epigenomics and Disease Susceptibility Meeting in Asheville, North Carolina. It was the first time the well-established organization had ever given a press pass. Jurdle was one of the organizers of the international meeting held in a historic and majestic southern resort spa tucked away in the Blue Ridge Mountains. 300 scientists and budding scientists traveled far to learn and share the cutting-edge epigenetic research.
And it's a testament, I think, to how important and how big the field of epigenetics really is. And as you know, when you look around the audience, many times I go to meetings and you see a lot of older people at the meetings, and that's about all that's in the audience too. That's not the case in epigenetics. Most of the people are very young. So it's a very rapidly growing new field is what we're seeing. Tremendously diverse in every way you can think of diversity. And also, I think we have people here from 23 different countries. And it's exciting. So young people know where the excitement is. They pick it up. They can have a feel for it. And if you're going to be going into something as a young person, you do not want to go into a calcified field because there's going to be no future for you. Whereas in a young growing field, there's a lot of niches that you can still fill and need to be filled, so there's a greater chance that you're going to be able to get a position, etc. So I think all of these add together to encourage people to look at the field of epigenetics.
Mendelian inheritance, Mendelian genetics, or Mendelism, refers to the transmission of hereditary characteristics from parent organisms to their offspring. This was discovered by Gregor Mendel in 1865. Mendelism underlies much of genetics today. According to Mendel's laws, if you were to take two flowers, for example, one purple and one white, and crossbreed them, you wouldn't come out with a mix of the two. In fact, the result of the crossbreeding is a purple flower. This is because the original purple flower had the dominant gene and thus hid the recessive gene, the white flower. Jurdle explains another way of getting variation, epigenetics, and why it is the impetus for this meeting.
In evolution, Mendel said that there's selection, positive or negative, for variations, basically. But where do these variations come from? The emphasis has always been on genetic changes causing these variations, and then they give rise to variation in characteristics, phenotypes, then can be selected for or against. But there's another type of way in which you can get variation, and that is through epigenetic changes, programs, changes in the programs that give rise to variation also. And it's becoming clearer that both not only are genetic changes involved in creating these variations that are selected for and ultimately even give rise to different species, but that epigenetic changes are also very, very important in creating a different type of variation. So if we are here, and in fact we rode, in other words, humans or any animal species, rode into this present time, in effect on the back of epigenetic variations and not just genetic variations, then it doesn't take a rocket scientist very long to realize that when you alter these epigenetic programs that give rise to these variations through environmental exposures, etc., that has a great potential now of creating what we call diseases like cancer and neurological disorders like schizophrenia, autism, bipolar disease, etc. And so the focus then of this meeting is the role in which epigenetics plays primarily in neurological problems.
Meeting presenter Christopher Badcock, reader in sociology in the London School of Economics, is a sociologist and social anthropologist who studies neurological disorders. He and his colleague Bernard Crespi developed the imprinted brain theory. Imprinted genes are those which are only expressed when they are inherited from one parent rather than the other. The theory points out that conditions like autism and schizophrenia come from extremely different traits, and the theory proposes that could result in a sort of tug of war, where the father's genes are pushing the developing brain towards autism, and the mother's genes are pulling in the opposite direction towards psychosis. Under this scenario, the best outcome is a tie where they meet in the middle, which is normalcy. Still with me? Okay, good. Badcock explains how we came up with the imprinted brain theory, which is considered a major contribution to psychiatry.
Well, I was originally appointed to a position in teaching sociology, and once I had tenure, I decided to abuse it by teaching what I thought we ought to be teaching rather than what we were at the time. I was appointed in 1974, and I quickly got rather disillusioned with traditional sociology. And then around about 1980, I first found out about the work of Bill Hamilton and Bob Trivers and people like that who had established a new evolutionary and genetic basis for the understanding of social behavior. So I got very much interested in that. And at the same time, I also developed an interest in psychoanalysis. In fact, I had a training analysis with Anna Freud, although I never actually practiced as a psychoanalyst. And I became convinced that psychoanalysis could be put on a firm foundation in genetic conflict. And I originally developed the idea in relation to sex chromosome conflict. When I found out about genomic imprinting in the early 1990s, I immediately saw that that was relevant. So I developed what at the time seemed a very convincing model, which said that the Freudian id was the psychological agent of paternally active, resource-demanding genes, because that's what paternally active genes do. The ego was the psychological agent of maternal, resource-limiting genes, and that was the kind of idea. But then I found out about autism research, and that really destroyed my faith in psychoanalysis and made me start to think completely differently about the mind. Because, of course, autism has given us tremendous insights into the mind because autistics have serious mental deficits. And wherever in medicine or science you find a deficit condition, you get tremendous insights into the normal state. And so that convinced me that Freudian psychology was all wrong.
Badcock says his theory could provide an explanation for mental illness.
The new idea was that autism might be the outcome of an imbalance in the expression of genes, because we've known for a long time that mental illnesses like autism and schizophrenia run in families, but they're not Mendelian. So how do you explain that? Epigenetics was the obvious answer, and I thought that my theory could explain it if you believe that an imbalance in the expression of the father's genes would push a person in the autistic direction, because the autistic mindset is more kind of male. I mean, some people call it extreme male brain. And that would mean that the contrary of that, a push in the direction of the mother's genes, including X chromosome genes, would push you towards psychotic conditions like schizophrenia. And again, we know that women are averagely more mentalistic than men. They have better mental skills, better interpretive skills, and so on. And the idea was that most people had already accepted that autism was hypomentalistic, in the sense that autistics lack mental skills like understanding intention, you know, reading people's facial expression, and so on. So I thought, well, if autism represents a deficit in these mental skills, why shouldn't psychoses like schizophrenia represent an overdevelopment, an overapplication of those same skills? So, for example, the idea is that whereas autistics have deficits in gaze monitoring and interpreting people's eyes and what they're saying, in paranoid schizophrenia you get the opposite of that. You get delusions of being watched or spied on, which is an oversensitivity to gaze. And in fact, we now know laboratory experiments have been done which have proved that paranoid schizophrenics are indeed hypersensitive to gaze direction, and borderline personality sufferers, which is a mild form of psychosis, have been shown to be better than normal at reading the expression in people's eyes. So this is the kind of thing that the theory says, and you can apply it to most of the other symptoms. For example, autistics are poor in interpreting people's intentions. They tend to fail to interpret them or to misinterpret them, whereas in paranoid psychosis, you get overinterpretation, but it can go either positively or negatively, because if you think about it, a person's intentions towards you can be positive or negative. If you overinterpret the positive, you get what's called erotomania, which is the belief that the other person's in love with you. A delusional belief that they're in love with you. That's much more common in women than in men. But the most common symptom of overinterpretation of intention is delusions of persecution, where you interpret the other person's intentions as completely negative to the point that you think you're being persecuted. And that's more common in men. Another thing you find that is a deficit in autism is a sense of self. Autistics don't develop a strong sense of their own individuality, whereas psychotics, again, particularly paranoid psychotics, develop megalomania and delusions of grandeur. You know, they think they're much, much more than they really are, and often it becomes completely absurd. So the theory says that most of the symptoms of autism and psychosis can be seen as diametrically opposite to each other. And these diametrically opposite symptoms are also found in epigenetic disorders where genes are expressed one way or the other. So, for example, there's a version of Williams syndrome which has deletions on chromosome 7, and this produces very talkative kids with so-called cocktail party skills. They relate very well to you. However, the duplication of the same part of chromosome 7, in other words, twice as many genes instead of none at all, produces the opposite symptom. They have severe language deficits, and they have symptoms of autism, like seizures and so on. There's a whole range of epigenetic disorders like that, which have these opposite symptoms. So that suggests to us that this diametrically opposite pattern of symptoms in autism spectrum disorders on the one hand and psychotic spectrum disorders on the other rests on a diametrically opposite genetic kind of seesaw effect related to the expression of genes either from the father or from the mother. So that's the basic theory. I mean, a recent finding only came out in the last couple of weeks in Nature, for example, was that people who suffer from traumatic stress disorder, who we've known for a long time, tend to be predominantly female. Women suffer from it more than men. They hypermentalize in the sense that they can't forget the trauma. You know, they have flashbacks, they have nightmares, they see things that constantly remind them, they constantly think about it. That's what I would call hypermentalize. You know, a normal person gets over it, moves on, and forgets it. They can't forget it, so they're hypermentalizing. So that suggests that post-traumatic stress disorder is in the psychotic spectrum on the hypermentalistic side. Now, a recent study showed that there's a particular gene related to this, and which produces a particular stress hormone, but the receptor for that stress hormone is estrogen-linked, so it affects women much more than men. So in other words, here is, if you like, more expression of maternal, or at least female genes. And of course, because all mothers are female, an estrogen receptor, it can be regarded as an expression of, you know, female genes. So the fact that more women than men suffer from PTSD and that it's an estrogen-linked receptor is exactly what our theory would predict.
Are there environmental factors then that can also predict when you're going to have more schizophrenia or more autism, and you're going to have more schizophrenia in times of famine?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the unexpected payoffs of the theory, because I never expected this would fall out of it, but it has come out of it very nicely, is that you can explain environmental factors like that. Because if you think about it, what is happening in fetal starvation is that an environmental insult, you know, a starving mother is mimicking the resource-limiting effects of maternal genes. So you could say that the environment is, as it were, mimicking or even interacting with resource-limiting maternal genes to produce a psychotic spectrum disorder as we predict. And indeed, as we saw at this conference, we discovered that the latest finding is that in these mothers, IGF-2 was down-regulated. Now, IGF-2 is a major growth factor gene which is paternally active, so it makes the baby bigger. But in schizophrenia, it appears that starvation down-regulates that gene. So in other words, the mother is limiting the resource-demanding effect of that paternal gene with a greater risk of schizophrenia being the result. Now, if that's true, though, it has a very deeply counterintuitive and surprising implication. See, it's easy to understand that an insult like a starving mother could have an unfortunate effect on her baby. But our theory says it could just as easily work the other way around. In other words, if mothers were better fed, that would mimic resource-demanding, paternally active genes like IGF-2 and provide more resources to the fetus, which would grow larger. And we know that autistics do grow larger. At least they have larger brains soon after birth and so on. So this suggests to me that rising living standards might explain part of the so-called autism epidemic. I mean, part of that is definitely much better diagnosis and more sensitivity to, you know, high-functioning autism. But it could well be that underlying that, there is a real increase in autism, and this is being caused by the exact opposite of maternal starvation, better maternal nutrition. And the interesting thing is that the co-discoverer of autism, Hans Asperger, discovered it in the late 1930s in Vienna. And when I looked at birth weight and maternal nutrition records in Vienna in the two or three decades preceding that, which happened to be rather good, I discovered that the researcher who recorded this information said that there had been an unprecedented rise in birth weights in Vienna immediately after World War I and right up to the beginning of World War II. So it's a funny coincidence that Asperger would discover the syndrome named after him, the autistic syndrome named after him, within a decade or two of unprecedented rises in birth weights in Vienna.
Badcock explains the implications of the theory and why there is a spectrum.
Gene expression needs to be balanced, and it normally is. So if you're lucky enough to have a normal, balanced expression of your mother's and your father's genes, then the implication is you will end up mentally normal, because your brain will develop to have enough mentalistic skill to interpret other people's intentions, but not so much as to get paranoid. Okay, so you know you're competent, but you're not overcompetent, as it were. Now, the idea is then that you can no longer see mental illness as something completely different from normality. Mental illness now becomes something that is at the end of a continuum that shades into normality with no clear point. I mean, you can't draw a line and say, you know, on this side everybody's sane and on that side they're mad. You can't say that anymore. All you can say is that there is a normal balance in the middle, which is, by the way, is offset slightly for men and women, because for men it's slightly offset to the autism side, because they do express slightly more paternal genes, if you think about it, because they have a Y chromosome, which women don't have. So there's a slight imbalance that because men have a Y chromosome, they express more paternal genes normally than women do. So this predicts that the balance for men on average and, you know, in general should be slightly offset towards the autistic side, which I think it is. And similarly, women would be offset slightly towards the psychotic side because they express two X chromosomes, which they get from their mother. So there's a doubling of the X chromosome, which has a kind of built-in female bias because women have two and men have only one. And indeed, the insights from cognitive science are that on average and in general, women are, as I said earlier, you know, slightly more mentalistic than men and men somewhat less. So that fits with normality. And the other implication of it, it has an important implication for psychotherapy, you see, because if this model is right, then what you need to do is to restore the balance. Now, we've known for a long time the one thing that works with autistics is mentalistic skills training, or social skills training. You know, teach them the skills they haven't got, and you will make them more normal, and it works to an extent. The surprising implication, though, on the other side is, if that's true, if making autistics more mentalistic makes them more normal, then making psychotics more autistic ought to help to return them to normality. Now, interestingly enough, there are some current ongoing experiments with schizophrenics which have shown that teaching them purely mechanistic skills in computer, you know, skills training improves their symptoms. And one that has been particularly good is pitch discrimination. A person listens to different tones and you say, is that one higher, is that one lower? Now, the interesting thing is, up to a third of autistics have perfect pitch. In other words, autistics are really good at pitch discrimination. And it's interesting that teaching pitch discrimination to psychotics seems to improve their symptoms. It's almost as if you're trying to push their cognitive configuration back, you see, towards the autistic end, which, according to this way of looking at mental illness, would improve them because you're moving them back towards a more balanced state of mind. So it does have some far-reaching implications for psychotherapy.
A fraught issue is gender susceptibility and what neurological disorders might affect one more than the other.
If you look at severe schizophrenia, if anything, it seems to affect more men than women. But interesting enough, if you also look at severe autism, you know, really severely disabled autistics who are completely mute, you find that the sex ratio is more or less equal. But at the high functioning end of autism, there are vastly more males than females. People say, you know, 10, 20 to 1. Now, I think that the situation is actually probably symmetrical and the same on the psychotic side. So it may be quite true that at the extreme end, there are as many men as women, often even more, slightly more men. But there is evidence that in milder forms like borderline personality disorder, you get three times as many women as men. And I think that in even milder, so-called high-functioning psychosis, you get vastly more women than men. But I believe they don't get diagnosed. And the reason they don't get diagnosed is, if you think about it, they must have very good social and mental skills. You see, the reason that autistics get easily diagnosed is they stand out. Their social skills are so bad that they create problems for themselves, which call for intervention and diagnosis. Now, if you can be borderline psychotic, but at the same time, according to this way of looking at things, have actually better than normal social skills, then you can probably get away with it because you'll have all kinds of clever ways of hiding your disability. Do you see what I mean? So you won't be so easily identified. So I think, in fact, there is. We'll find in the end, you know, when we can do a proper epigenetic test to see where a person lies on this. On this spectrum, we'll probably find there are as many on each side, and furthermore, there's a female excess on the psychotic side, just as we know there's a male excess on the autistic side.
And then what about the age differences, like such as autism? It's a very early onset, right?
That falls out very nicely from our theory, because you see, if autism is a disorder of hypomentalism, too little mentalism, stunted social and interpersonal skills, you're going to notice that early on, because children have to acquire those during childhood. And indeed, it takes a long time to get the full set of mentalistic skills that an adult person needs. Now, if our theory is right, in order to become hypermentalistic, to overdevelop those skills, you have first to develop them. So therefore, psychotic illnesses like schizophrenia shouldn't be seen until a person has gone through the normal process of development during adolescence. They should become apparent in late adolescence or early adulthood, which by and large they do.
And these disorders can be determined in the womb while the fetus is still developing.
It's important to remember, though, that we already know that developmental insults can also produce these outcomes. For example, valproic acid, which is a common medication taken for epilepsy, that valproic acid poisoning in the mother does produce autism. And we know from animal studies that valproic acid affects epigenetic gene expression. It affects methylation. So it could well be that things like maternal diet, poisons like valproate and so on could also do it. But of course, what would be critical is when. There are probably certain vulnerable periods during development, in pregnancy, both before birth and perhaps afterwards, when a certain particular kind of environmental effect or toxin or genetic glitch would be important, which might not be important at some other time.
But it is not all bad news, he says. These disorders can also benefit the individual.
Our modern view of mental illness, if you want to call it that, is that there are pluses and minuses. And so we're much more aware now that on the autistic side, you also get so-called autistic savantism. You can get remarkable cognitive gifts that go with autism, such as fantastic memory, tremendous math skills and stuff like that. And similarly, there's also a good body of literature now that shows that people, particularly on the mildly psychotic side, can also have very great gifts for things like literature, art, drama and stuff like that. So one shouldn't forget that there are gifts as well as deficits in these things. And one thing I hope that my theory would do is to lead to a more kind of sophisticated and open-minded concept about, you know, the mind and so-called mental illness, where we see all of these facets and don't just concentrate on, you know, what could be labelled as a disability or a disorder and not see the bigger picture.
That was Christopher Badcock, reader of sociology at the London School of Economics. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery. Thank you for listening.